Welcome to the Couchcast. I'm Mark Ovenden, and we are having our second chat with international BAFTA award-winning TV director Jeff Posner. Welcome back to the Couchcast, Jeff.
Thank you. I must say it's lovely being here with you.
Now, in our first programme, which you can still listen to as a podcast, we were talking about what happened when your first series of As Seen on TV was transmitted on BBC Two.
So the BBC kind of said, well, we'll put you on BBC Two and see how it goes.
And how well did it go?
It went extremely well. And I can't deny that I was really pleased because, you know, when you record a programme like this, the audience who come to see the show don't really know what they're coming to see. And some of them didn't even know Vic. Some of them had come because BBC audience research had kind of looked for them and said, we think you might like this programme. Why don't you come along? And that was one of the big differences between the Granada series and myself, which was that the Granada series invited anybody who was around, whereas we took care as to who came to the audience. I have to say, when we showed it in the studio, there was one bit of the programme that people really didn't understand at all because they'd never seen anything like it. Can you guess what it was?
Not the mockumentaries.
Not the mockumentaries. Acorn Antiques.
Really?
Well, you see, Vic stood up and said, and now our very own soap opera. And they saw it and they thought, well, I'm sure I saw the scenery move then. Oh, well, and I'm sure. Why was she late in coming on? They really didn't understand what it was about.
Is that why there's not too many laughs in the background of it then?
Well, that is sort of deliberate. You see, when you do something that's not good, you have to persuade all the camera and sound and lighting and everything else to not do their job properly. And I couldn't trust that to happen with an audience there. And in any case, the audience would distort it because the cast would have to wait for the audience to laugh. So I deliberately shot it like it was a real soap opera, sort of 4 minutes on the trot. So there isn't much space for the audience to laugh. And that's why there's not much laughter on it, because I wanted people to hear and understand and look visually what we were doing rather than be distracted as it might be by audience. You know, there's plenty of other audience laughs in the rest of the programme. So that's why. They were watching a screen. And the first time it went through in the studio, they watched programme one and they thought, meh, there was very little stuff there. And so I then showed programme two. And in programme two, what happened in one scene was that Julie was off stage with a tray of biscuits. And as she came on, she'd eaten a biscuit. She opened her mouth and spat all the biscuit all over Vic. And of course, everybody corpsed. The whole cast corpsed. We had to stop and go back again. And we reshot the scene. She learned not to spit the biscuit out. And so when I came to edit it together, I thought, why don't I keep the first take in and then cut to black and put the second take in and carry on the scene? That might give the audience some clue. And it's at that moment, when we showed it to the audience in the studio, that the studio audience clicked as to what it was. Although this isn't the same kind of joke as the rest of Acorn Antiques, it did the job of persuading people that it was a programme about spoofs. And from that moment on, the audience in the studio were with us. And that happened every week, practically. You know, there was a fresh audience and they didn't know what they were coming to.
Oh, very clever technique, actually, to let them in on the joke. Can I just ask, you said you shot 34 minutes of material. What happened to those extra bits? Have they ever been collated and brought together? Do they still survive?
No, because I was of the belief that if it's not good enough to go into a programme, it shouldn't be seen. Nowadays, you can get the whole... I mean, this podcast will go on containing all my mistakes and all my indiscretions, whereas the radio stuff will be much shorter. And I really think that the sketches weren't shown because I didn't think they were up to the standard of everything else that we shot, which was an extremely high standard, and I just didn't want them seen, and the BBC didn't keep them either, and I didn't have any record of them. So all that exists are some scripts which Jasper Rees, who wrote the book about Victoria, found, but no evidence exists now of the sketches that we shot.
Wow, that would be a great discovery if anyone managed to sneak a copy of that out, but probably it's been lost forever, Jeff.
Well, you know, I'm surprised where stuff came from. I shot a pilot with Madness in 1982, actually. That was a very busy year for me because I thought Madness would be the next Monkees, if you remember them. You know, Ben Elton and Richard Curtis writing a script and some of Madness would appear in it. We shot it. I didn't do the boys justice. It was shot in a hell of a hurry. We couldn't shoot it properly. We had no money and all of those excuses that I always give. And it disappeared. Suddenly, it appears on the internet. And I thought, How did that happen? I still don't know, because there was no copy in VT Library at the BBC, because I tried to get it out. Nobody could find it, but it existed on somebody's cupboard. They opened it and there was a Madness Pilot sitting there. So I hope they find some more somewhere.
I hope there's some lovely collector. So that series that you worked on with Vic came to be known of as Seen on TV, and has since arguably become one of the best programmes of all time. It won several BAFTAs. But during those early days of production, did you have any kind of inkling of what kind of a big hit it would become, Jeff?
Oh, no, you never do. You know, you never know. You should never go into a show thinking, this is so fantastic, this will win a BAFTA. And for all the reasons I've explained to you, you know, the BBC weren't fantastically confident about it in the beginning, but obviously it became better known, and then it became a bit of a cult. That put an enormous pressure on Vic. And so, you know, series two took a bit of writing time, and then she did some extraordinary Christmas specials, which everybody adores, I know. And then she decided that writing sketches was enough. You know, when you write a sketch, it's a 3-minute bit of reality. You have to invent characters, invent the situation, invent punchlines. It's a hell of a difficult thing to do. And she just decided that that was enough, and she wanted to go on to more long-form stuff. And she confided in me that she loved watching sitcoms, and in the distant future, she might write a sitcom.
That was what later became Dinner Ladies, but before we get to that, what is kind of the essence of what you might think of as good comedy? How do you see the timing, the delivery, the words? Is it just the northern accent, the casual mentioning of intimate objects like peg bags? What is it that made those things so funny?
The lot. It's all. But most importantly, it's Vic putting it together in her way. And Vic had a way of writing. I mean, I'm not being too nerdy when I say it was a bit like poetry, because she had a rhythm of delivering her lines that she wanted everybody else to follow. Every word was considered, and she knew how it should be performed because she'd written and said it, and I'd heard it read in that famous first session with Julie. Some of the actors found it difficult to do exactly the right tempo that the line is written in. I'll give you an example. Dear old Pat Routledge said to me, there's a line in Kitty called, I definitely detected a tang of Clearasil. And she said, I can't say it. She said, can I substitute it with something else? And I said, no, because every word has been written deliberately in that way for you to say it in that way. And so you can't paraphrase it at all. Lots of actors found that a real problem. And there was one line in Kitty, for example, which I think is a genius line and geniusly delivered by the late Patricia Routledge, which was, and I know you'll know this line, I've just had my TV mended. Well, when I say mended, a shifty-looking youth came and waggled my aerial and wolfed my gypsy creams, but that's the comprehensive system for you. Now, how many constituent parts are there to that sentence? There's shifty-looking youth, waggled my aerial, it couldn't be wiggled my aerial or whatever. And of course, it had to be gypsy cream. So you're right about the not generically, it has to be the name of a product. And Patricia said to me, where do I get to breathe in that sentence? And I said, you don't. You just go for it and deliver it all in one go. And that's part of the secret of how she wanted the lines delivered, because at the end of the sentence, it's a surprise. It's got so many bits in it that it covers a lot of ground, and that's the way Vic wrote.
It's very precise, isn't it? It's very analytically done. Very clever.
It is.
So clever. So one of the defining and most quoted sketches, of course, was Acorn Antiques. We talked a little bit about it earlier on. You mentioned that Julie, as Mrs. Overall, got the whole cast corpsing. They couldn't stop laughing. How did you, as a director, work with moments like that? How do you pull everyone back in line, knowing what the time restrictions are for studios and all that kind of thing?
Not easily, is all I can say. Right at the very beginning, I said to the cast, look, the thing about Acorn Antiques is that it's written as a soap opera, and the cast in it really believe they're doing a good job. occasionally things go wrong, like Mrs. Overall is late coming on stage or says the wrong things, or you see things you're not supposed to. But then I referenced a programme called Crossroads that went out on ITV in the 60s, which had some mistakes in it, but because there was no facility to record and go back over it, they just put it out. And I watched a lot of those. And I said, you go for it for real and don't laugh. It's not funny. What you think you're doing is serious, like a proper soap opera. Now, there was one moment when Acorn Antiques was being converted into a leisure centre when they got Mrs. Overall dressed up in lumpy tights and the cast hadn't seen it. And I used to like jamming the cast into a small sofa so they were all scrunched up next door to each other because it looks very awkward and I loved those elements of it. And so there they were, jammed up on the sofa, and Julie walked in these tights, and I could see Celia start to laugh, and I could see because I had a reverse shot behind her shoulders and they were going up and down, and then I could see it spread to Vic and then spread to Duncan at the end, and I couldn't stop them laughing because each time she came on they couldn't stop themselves. And of course, as you know too well, as is the case with this programme, we're against the clock. And dinner break was coming at 6 o'clock, and at dinner break everybody had to get changed. I had to get it in the can by 6 o'clock. And that is the only time I think I've ever raised my voice when I said, if I don't get this done, we're never going to get it done. And they did calm down. But I allowed them that because they were so wonderful throughout it all and did exactly what they needed to do, as was the crew, of course, in achieving the kind of mistakes that no crew would want to achieve. You know, like somebody standing up and hitting their head on a boom. And we took about 5 or 6 goes to get that right because it was the reflex of the boom operator to take the boom out of the way when he stood up. That's what they always do. And I said, no, he's got to hit his head on it. No, all that kind of stuff.
You anyway, must hurt Duncan Preston.
Yes, it did. That is precisely why I always pre-recorded Acorn Antiques so I could cut together and they could see it as I wanted them to see it.
Now, during the rest, I can talk about Acorn Antiques and Victoria Wood till the cows come home, I'm sure. But during the rest of the 80s and 90s, you did help discover and develop many other comedians of the era. Where did you find them all?
Well, I did this show with Paul Jackson called Saturday Live. There were 3 series hosted by Ben Elton. And we used to go out and look for new comedians that had never appeared on television. And we found people like Joe Brand and Paul Merton and Julian Clary, who didn't fall into any of the categories that traditional TV programmes accepted. And so we, I suppose, discovered a lot of people. And I went to Edinburgh and saw Harry Enfield produce a character that was set in the 30s. And he came back and we shot a whole lot of films in that style. And then he incorporated it into his programme and Harry became a star in his own right. Mm. So I loved that moment when you didn't go out and discover somebody, but you just did a pilot with them. Nobody knows I did a pilot with Vic and Bob, Reeves and Mortimer, for Channel 4, which then became Big Night Out, because I loved going out and moulding a show full of people who didn't quite know. In fact, let's face it, if we go back to The Young Ones, one of the joys of The Young Ones was that it was written by people who had no experience of writing for television. So they would write lines like, I wish I was a fly on the wall, cut to a mock fly on the wall who speaks. Well, they didn't know that was going to be really difficult to do. They just wrote it because they wanted to see it. Mm. That's part of the joy of working with people who aren't used to doing television and just dying for exposure. And I loved bringing them out into the front. I formed a company called Positive, and we did programs with people like John Sessions, the Doug Anthony All-Stars, the Fabulous Singlets. We did a spoof Marriage of Figaro, which was done in English and explained the plot of an opera. We did pantomimes, and we had a big radio wing which brought lots of people into the public eye. So it was wonderful doing it in those days and going out to clubs and finding people. We were very busy during the 80s and early 90s.
Well, thank goodness that you were, because you really have helped to produce the backbone of British comedy, effectively. Especially thank with you. Programmes like Blankety Blank, Little and Large, Carrots Lib, Lenny Henry, Paul Merton, as you mentioned, Harry Enfield, of course, Josie Lawrence. Do tell us about some of those other great shows, some of the people you worked with.
Well, have a look at some of the early Steve Coogan stuff. We did two video diaries with Steve at a very early stage in his career, featuring two characters which perhaps wouldn't be favourite characters in this day and age, but in the 90s they were really very, very funny characters, Paul Karff and Pauline Karff. Mm. And Steve as Pauline Karff was extraordinary. I have to shout out to Lisa Cavelli-Green, who's a makeup supervisor, who created the look of Pauline Karff for Steve. And it was extraordinary to think that Steve was underneath all of that. And my memory is we shot in a very rough part of Manchester. Yes, there are some, but we shot in that deliberately. And I remember Steve going for a lunch break, and he used to stand in the queue, like everybody else did, dressed as Pauline Karff. And I just remember the looks of people in the street looking at this extraordinary character. And it was such a joy working with him. He had this instinct for delivering a line. And to work with people like that, and also Matt and David later on in the form of Little Britain, they had this connection in those days that they were just wonderful things to do with them. And you know, the job, my job is not to be famous. My job is just to bring them and present them in the best light so the public can see them in their best light, and then just stay out of the limelight, stay in the shadows, and have the fun.
Yeah, it's like they have these ideas in their heads, wouldn't it be great to see? And then your job is to make us be able to see that from what's inside their heads. Yeah.
Sometimes it's good. Sometimes you have to say, well, I don't think that'll work. And this is the reason I don't think that'll work. Not easy, but everybody I worked with was really good about what they wanted to see and what was perhaps not quite what they wanted to see. And it's just been a joy. I can't work with people I don't really get on with. I understood Vic. I got Vic, and I got the way that Vic worked, and so I hope I presented her work in the best possible way. That was my job.
I thought you were going to say in the best possible taste.
I know, I know. It's impossible not to think of those legs crossing. Kenny Everett was another one I would have wanted to work with, but the year wasn't long enough to do everything.
No, and of course we lost him way, way too early. Oh. How did you manage the workload? You were doing so much with so many people.
Well, I don't know. At the BBC, you were used to working on two or three series a year because it had all this administrative structure. And you'd say, I'd like to go filming. How long? 2 weeks? Yeah, 2 weeks. Where? Do you want to film outside? Yes, we film outside London. They had this structure built up. It had all of the departments like visual effects, makeup, wardrobe. It was an extraordinary place. Cost a packet to run. And it's no surprise that it's a shadow of its former self. And even now, you open the papers and see how many staff are being shed from the BBC. But in those days, it was a huge organisation, and you didn't have to worry much about money because the money was there, otherwise you wouldn't get the budget for the programme. They made sure you had enough money to make the programme rather than the other way round, asking for money and thinking, how am I going to make it on this budget? So it was a wonderful place to work without the financial constraints, although we all knew what the programme cost, and if it overran in terms of money, we'd be called into account. But at least you could get on with seeing what the joke was and how best to present it. And so you could overlap programmes. And there was 1 year also, the BBC employed you for the whole year. It wasn't a freelance thing in the early days. So they'd say, right, this is your year. You do Vic in January and February. And then you can take a holiday in Easter time. And then you go on to French and Saunders. And then there's a series with Lenny Henry to do. And then when I left the BBC to go freelance, you can have the rest of it. Yeah, I said, well, I'm doing Saturday Live for ITV and Channel 4. Yes, okay, you can have the end of the year, you can disappear, but come back to us. It was extraordinary. And of course, there's so much unemployment in the industry nowadays, I don't think anybody has that kind of workload. But these were programmes, Mark, that I loved doing, so I didn't mind that there was an overlap, and all the staff in the office used to work on two programmes at a time, and it was a wonderful way to work.
It sounds incredible, period. I thought you were about to quote some of the other great comedians you worked with, French and Saunders, when they did their famous lines about nobody knows what the hell's going on.
No, nobody did. Nobody did. I did two fabulous series with Dawn and Jennifer. I found them really wonderful to work with. But again, you know, my year was full and I couldn't fit everything in. And they went on to do some extraordinary stuff with John Plowman as producer. And I just loved my time working with them.
They were a great pair of comics which contributed so much to people's lives. Now, Vic herself got commissioned for some other longer form shows as well, some that you were involved in, some that you weren't. But I think one of her most impressive was the All Day Breakfast. It was such a parody of that TV format.
Yes.
How did they let you get away with it?
Well, it wasn't a case. case of letting us get away with it. We did it. And although the people that we were parodying were quite obvious at the time, it was generic enough to say, well, a lot of programs have this kind of jokey relationship between the presenters that you can see they hate each other in real life. And so lots of programs fell into that category. So we didn't really parody anything. And a lot of Vic's work is parodying stuff, because even As Seen on TV had loads of parodies. We did documentaries, we did spoof adverts, we made Acorn Antiques, which was the biggest parody of all time. So there were lots of parodies. Vic loved parodying things, and we just went ahead and did it. Nobody batted an eyelid, and it seems to be one of her favourite programmes. It was a Christmas show, and she had very little time to do it in. So I'm amazed it turned out as well as it did.
Well, it's certainly one of my favourites anyway. And sticking in the same period, in the mid-1990s, you branched out again to other aspects of telly. You told us at the beginning how you were involved in Top of the Pops, and I believe you were asked to direct Eurovision.
Yes. Well, Britain hasn't won Eurovision very often, as you know, and in 1997, Katrina and the Waves produced the winning song, and the BBC had to stage Eurovision in 1998 in Birmingham. And the head of entertainment, Paul Jackson, with whom I worked on Carrot's Lib, so live television was never much a problem to me. In fact, I always wanted to do more live television, which is something most people run away from, but I just adore it. I adore the adrenaline of it. He picked up the phone and said, Jeff, you know we won Eurovision in Dublin this year. Would you? Yes. I didn't know what the end of the sentence was, Mark, but I just said yes immediately. And I thought, what happens if he was going to ask me, would you like to be a floor manager or something? No, but he wasn't, obviously. I had no hesitation, and it proved to be one of the most extraordinary shows I've ever done, because, of course, you had all the countries who wanted the show to present their artist in the best possible light. And now I have to say, I'm going to stick my neck out, but now I have to say it is one of the most extraordinarily well-produced and directed shows, music shows on television. You know, I'll admit, if you watch my Eurovision show, it looked very old-fashioned, in inverted commas. Well, it was in 98, you know, 30 years ago. So it did look like shows looked then. We had no screens, we had no moving lights, we had very little to work with, and that meant we had to give everything a different feel as much as we could with the limitations that we could. Nowadays, there are no limitations. But Eurovision was something that I wasn't quite aware of how many people were going to be watching it until that moment. And this is a moment when every person who directs a live program will know. You get fed in the scanner, which is the place where the gallery with the control desk, you get fed BBC One output beforehand, and you hear, and now on BBC One, we cross over to Birmingham for the 1998 Eurovision Song Contest. And I don't know anybody that doesn't think, I'm going to do a little bit of wee now. That is the worst time, you know, just before you, once you're on air, it's wonderful, but it's that little moment just before you do that you think, oh, this is a big bugger, this is a big show. But it's one of the things that you cherish, because I went on to do a lot of live stuff afterwards as well, which I absolutely adored. I didn't leave comedy behind, but it was like comedy was my job and music was my hobby.
Mm-hmm. Beautifully put. And unfortunately, a perfect place for us to draw this chat to a close for this week, Jeff.
Oh, no.
It's been such a complete honour to have had the chance to ask you these questions and listen to your stories, Jeff. Thank you so much for joining us.
And thank you for inviting me to the Isle of Wight.
We are going to have to invite you back, that's for sure.
It's a lovely studio you have here, Mark. Anyway.
Thank you. It's all rag rolled. So do come back to the Catchcast another time and listen to more of our wonderful guests.